Life in prison from both sides of the bars. Most of us haven't spent any time on the inside of a prison cell, but we've read accounts of prisoners, of journalists, and others who've experienced prison firsthand. Prisoner advocates in Maine say the system designed for righting wrongs done to inmates is stacked against them, and that steps must be taken to give prisoners more of a voice. I'm Keith Shortall. Today we'll hear from two people who know what it's like on the inside. One, a former inmate turned advocate. The other, a former prison guard who's written a new book about his experiences working in prisons in Pennsylvania and here in Maine. We'll explore the real world of prison, the internal politics, the policies, and the people that define the system funded by the taxpayers to keep dangerous criminals in, punish those who've committed crimes against society, and some would argue to deter us from committing crimes in the first place. First, this news. From the MPBN studios, I'm Keith Shortall, and this is Maine Calling. News out of upstate New York about two escaped prisoners has news networks abuzz with stories about how they managed their escape, how they planned it, where they got the tools. Meanwhile, everyday life continues for prisoners and their jailers in facilities around the country with much less media attention. Today we're going to take a closer look at that prison life. We'll speak with a former guard and from a former prisoner about what it's like to be confined behind bars and to work in a prison setting. With me in our Portland studio, Robert Riley. He's worked as a prison guard at the Maine State Prison. He lives in Midcoast, Maine with his wife and three children and is an outdoor education instructor. He's the author of the memoir Life in Prison, 8 Hours at a Time. Also with us today, Joseph Jackson. He's a former prisoner and now a coordinator of the Maine Prisoner Advocacy Coalition. As always, we want to hear from you as well. What questions do you have about life in prison? Our phone number is 800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. Our email address is talk@mpbn.net, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. And a programming note, click on over to the Maine Calling Facebook page or to the MPBN website to listen to MPBN Deputy News Director Susan Sharon's recent two-part series on the grievance process for Maine state prisoners that we have aired over the past 2 days. Robert and Joseph, welcome to Maine Calling.
Well, thank you, Keith.
Thank you.
Joseph Jackson, let's start with you. Tell us your story. How long did you spend in prison and where?
I went to prison in 1995 for manslaughter. I spent most of my time at Maine State Prison, the old place in Warren, and in 2002 I was transferred to the new facility. I also been in four of the other five or six facilities in the state, so I've been in many of the institutions and dealt with many of the people, the entire time. I spent 20 years inside.
Yeah. We'll talk about what it was like inside, but then talk about a little bit, if you would, about why you moved to advocacy. Was it your experience in there that made you decide that people needed help?
Well, yes. I'm actually one of the founders of the Maine State Prison branch of the NAACP. About 10 years ago, a friend and I began that group because, minority prisoners weren't getting a fair shake in very many areas of the facility. I mean, a lot of the paying jobs they weren't having access to. A lot of staff people could use, derogatory terms against them with impunity, and there was no type of recourse. So we felt like we had to found this group to try to bring some type of balance to that. And so we did that, and with some partners from the outside.
And you're working now, as we've heard in Susan's reports over the past 2 days, on the grievance process. But explain to us what the issue is there.
Well, the grievance process is there's a lot of problems with the grievance, and really it's in the language that is used in the policy. I mean, a lot of grievances are tossed out for just technicalities. I mean, regardless of whether or not the complaint has merit or not, at the first level, I mean, just for writing outside a line, a guy can get his grievance thrown out, and the issue or the complaint cannot be raised again. Subsequently, the grievance process policy is also the way that a prisoner can get his complaint into a court. And if a prisoner don't follow the procedure precisely, it's automatically thrown out of court. And so many times, a prison official will wait up to the last minute to respond. And then by the time that the prisoner gets the letter back, he's already ran out of time. So,
all right. We'll talk more about that, too. Robert Riley, you worked as a guard a total of 6 years in a number of facilities. Tell us briefly about your experience.
Yes, I started work actually in a facility just outside Philadelphia in eastern Pennsylvania, and I worked for 4 years there. And then we moved to Maine, and I, in essence, transferred into the Maine state system and worked for 3 years there. So all in all, it was 7 years.
You were originally, you were trying to create a life as a musician. You were born in England and were trying to make a career in music. How did you end up in corrections?
Well, I was working as a musician, scraping a living, really. And my wife and I had started a family, and she wanted to be home with the children. And we were doing the sort of 5 o'clock kiss and switch. So I would be home with the children during the day, and then she would come home from work and I would leave. And she was desperately unhappy at her job. And so I had applied for a job after a neighbor had suggested it at the local prison. And it was more about wages and benefits than anything else.
You really had doubts about whether this was the sort of career for who you were, but you really needed the gig.
That's exactly right. My neighbor, I remember telling my neighbor, you know, I'm not a tough guy. That's not me. I can't do that. And he said, oh, no. I see you in the neighborhood. You're a people person. He had a relative working there. He said, it's a people job. You'll be fine. And then when he said, you know, it's 40 grand a year and it's a Teamster's job, great benefits, that really pushed me over the edge.
You chronicle really nicely, if I can use that word, in a somewhat, it's a dark book because of the experiences there, but you do put human faces on the inmates, on the guards, and really paint a picture of what it was like and what it was like for someone like you who was really just looking for a living, but also I guess the really shock is not too hard a word to use as you got into the system and saw what it was really like.
Yeah, I'm a very lucky person in the fact that I'm from a very normal family and I'm married into a very normal family. And while I've had great experiences and traveled, I didn't really have a full grip on dysfunction and what happens to folks who don't have it as good as I do. And I very quickly realized that both guards and inmates were quite similar in lots of ways, that they were both trapped by economic necessity or the lack of economic opportunity. So the guards were trapped by the necessity to make a living, and in many cases the inmates were there because of no opportunities. And there was a lot of similarities between staff and inmates.
There was a joke. I grew up in Thomaston, home of the former Maine State Prison, and there was a common joke about how do you tell the difference between the guards and the inmates at the prison, and the punchline is it's the uniform.
Right.
Joseph Jackson, tell us a little bit then about what life was like. For example, when you first arrived in prison, were you prepared, and what was it like?
Well, I don't think nothing could prepare someone for entering prison. I actually went to Thomaston first, so I was in the old facility. It was an old, dilapidated joint. The bottom toilets froze during the winter, and then at the top, when the metal got warm, there was no relief. So it was, but just not just the physical part of, but the mental torment was, I think, the biggest part of it. You know, what rules to follow when, you know, prison officials cherry pick which policies, you know, they want to apply at a time, you know, and when a policy, you know, favors a prisoner, they never, you know, go that route with that policy.
And you had to figure out the internal politics as well, right? Not just with the guards, how to maybe get along with the guards or avoid trouble, but also with other inmates.
Well, true, but it's also what guards, you know, there's one guard, you know, he may come in that day and you know your day is going to be a hell of a day. There's another day when you have a guard come in, you know that, you know, the day is going to be okay. So I mean, yeah, you have to learn those kind of things.
So was it more challenging getting along with other prisoners or with the guards?
I think it's both. I mean, I didn't have any challenge getting along with prisoners. Most people, you know, that's the most respectful place for me in America is in a prison because, you know, you get within 2 feet of anybody, somebody's saying, excuse me. You don't get very much of that in the real world now. So from that standpoint, no, it wasn't very difficult to get along with prisoners. I dealt with everybody from period. The staff, regardless of however you interact with the staff, they're good people. But then they're just some staff; they're not going to like you no matter what, and they like other people, and it just goes vice versa. And once you get on the bad side, you know, it's over.
Yeah, Robert, in your book, you tell very clearly talk about how as a young guard, you were trained, you were given this protocol of training, and that you discovered, well, first of all, tell us about the training and how it did not apply to the job that you finally got.
That's great because this is radio, but we're both smiling here. The training at both prisons was completely disconnected in almost every way to the work on the floor and the work of interacting respectfully with inmates. I often felt that it was a sort of a politically correct firewall that the administration was building, that they would have staff attend and complete all these classes, tick the boxes, and then if there was some sort of incident during the working part of that person's life, it was an opportunity for them to be fired because they've had the class. This is how they should act and interact. They're in violation of what they've been taught in class. So it was a way of getting rid of staff. Nothing quite prepared you, and most of it's classroom. Nothing quite prepares you for being on your own in a cell block with 60 to 90 inmates. It's you. And you work there, they live there.
And so in addition to when you first start out, it's somewhat like a boot campish in terms of you need to, pass the physical test and do some running and show that you can lift a certain amount. But later on in the process, there are psychological screening questions, which were interesting. And you thought fairly obvious.
Yeah, the process in Pennsylvania was very different. And I think that had everything to do with hundreds and hundreds of people going for 12 spots, sort of the edge of the Rust Belt. Lots of manufacturing was closing down or going overseas. So there was a huge pool of applicants. So the process in Pennsylvania was quite rigorous. Psychological, there was interviews, there was here at the main state prison, it was very different. If you were breathing, the joke was, if you were breathing, they'll give you a job. And it was very, very different.
The screening questions in Pennsylvania, though, were kind of to weed out what appeared to be anyone who might have effeminate.
Yeah, they were great. I mean, there were some really overtly feminine, masculine questions. Would you rather be a sports reporter or report on the arts? Would you rather be a lumberjack or a florist? I mean,
so you knew how you were supposed to answer.
It was really, really funny. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. And then, so you get to on the first day of being a guard in Pennsylvania, you realize that none of this training is going to really help you, and that it's really about your relationships with not only with the inmates but with your fellow guards.
Yeah, that's exactly right. You had to find a way of communicating that was where you're adhering to the rules of the institution, but also getting some respect from the people that you were looking after, overseeing for that 8-hour shift. And that's where the real learning piece came. And for me, the way I did it was I was polite. I stuck to the rules. I called everybody by their last name. And if possible, I tried to help where I could. And during tense or difficult situations, I just would de-escalate and try and find common ground and resolve the issue. And it was a magic trick, actually. Just being polite and human worked for me.
Did other guards or supervisors challenge that style?
Oh, yeah. There was one very difficult incident I had not long after starting the job, where I was given the assignment from a shift commander to take a sex offender from a general housing unit to a protective custody unit. It was down the end of a long corridor, and I was just about to go through the door, and two guards I only knew by reputation told me to stop and wait, and I knew exactly what they wanted. There was no cameras in the hallway connecting the corridor to the PC unit. So I was pressing the button to be let in, because I knew once I was in that door, it would shut behind me and lock. And as they were coming towards me, I was pressing the button. The guy in the control center was getting cross with me for continually pressing the button. Anyway, the door clicked. I pushed the inmate through. I closed it behind me. And these two thugs were on the other side, giving me the hands in the face. What are you doing? What are you doing? So I put my charge into the protective custody unit, signed him in, left, and they were waiting for me in the corridor outside. And the question was, what are you doing, Riley? We were going to get some. I mean, they were going to beat this guy up because he was a sex offender.
Joseph Jackson, you were saying that you knew it was going to be a hard day if there was a certain guard on duty or a supervisor on duty. What were the good ones like?
I mean, the good ones, well, just like what he just described, you know, they treated you with respect. I mean, and respect went both ways. If you went to them with a problem or issue, I mean, they tried to help you if they could, you know, I mean, if it was in their power, you know. They didn't go out of their way to think that that it was their job to punish you. And so the bad ones, if you want me to say that, that's what they think. They think it's their job to punish you and not the time that the judge gave you being the punishment.
So do you think that the bad ones, as you describe them, enjoyed that was part of their satisfaction, or it was more part of their duty?
Well, I think they enjoyed. I think there was a part of them that, you know what I mean, felt like, you know what I mean, like they got somebody today, and that, you know, that having that power over another person, you know what I mean, it's, you know, I guess to some people, you know what I mean, feels good. And they didn't make a mistake about showing it, you know, those ones that were like that.
Yeah, I was told at one point by a guy who had been there for probably 10 years at the Maine State Prison, he told me that I had to learn to hate the inmates. And I said, what do you mean? I was sort of slightly confused. He said, well, once you learn to hate the inmates, everything becomes easier. It's us and them.
We'll take a quick break. When we come back, we want to hear from you. The number to join the conversation, 800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Sweetser, offering mental health first aid classes in several Maine locations, course description, and class schedule at sweetser.org. Casella, committed to increasing recycling rates while reducing residential trash and landfill loads through zero-sort recycling. Casella, giving resources new life. And Freemasons in Maine, supporting Maine Public Broadcasting's efforts to provide knowledge, wisdom, and entertainment to the people of Maine.
On the next Ian Rehm Show, in his decades in politics, Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders has been a progressive voice on income inequality, health care, and immigration reform. A conversation with Bernie Sanders on his run for president.
Join us for the Ian Rehm Show this afternoon at 2 o'clock. The public is invited to attend any open meeting of Maine Public Broadcasting Network's Governing Board and Advisory Committee meetings. For more information regarding specific dates, times, and locations of the Maine Public Broadcasting Network's open meetings, visit our website, mpbn.net, or you can call Audience Services at 1-800-884-1717.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Keith Shortall. Today on the program, what life is like inside prison. With me in the studio, Joseph Jackson. He's a former prisoner, now coordinator of the Maine Prisoner Advocacy Coalition. Robert Riley is the author of Life in Prison, 8 Hours at a Time. We invite you to join the conversation. The number, 800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. Email talk at mpbn.net. Tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. Robert Riley, the opening scene in your book, as I read last night from beginning to end, I couldn't put it down. I was really interested in it. Is shocking. I don't know how else to describe it. It is a scene of an extraction from a maximum security or supermax unit. I don't want to read from it. It's a little gruesome, violent, and disturbing. But would you say that that is the worst that prison experience got, or one of the worst things?
I think it's part of the worst experience. In that passage of the book, the extraction is gruesome and violent, and it's bloody and horrible. And parts of the extraction team are enjoying it. But really, what lies beneath that is that the inmate was a mentally ill inmate. And that's really the true tragedy of the extraction. It's violent and horrible. But what's worse than that is that the inmate had a mental age of a 10-year-old. And he was locked up in a maximum security prison unit. And he was a violent, dangerous person who was an adult and physically powerful. But he had a mental age of a 10-year-old. And those issues aren't being addressed and just don't make any headlines.
I was going to say that, you know, that for me, I think destruction is just the beginning of the trauma for the prisoner. I mean, because then you go to a chair and you're strapped in it butt naked, you know what I mean, for a lot of hours. And, you know, and sometimes, you know, the pepper spray that you use, it takes a long time for them to even get it cleaned off. And afterwards, you go into an observation cell where they just give you a blanket and no clothes. So the traumatic part just begins with the extraction.
I agree with that, yeah.
And just to summarize, so the inmate is naked. He's got a blade. He starts to cut himself. In comes this cadre of uniformed, suited officers, and they restrain, quote unquote, restrain him using fairly significant force. So there's blood, other bodily fluids all over the place. People are slipping and sliding. At the end of the scene, though, one of the most disturbing things is how you describe the reaction of this inmate as you're walking away from him. He's covered in blood and fluids.
Yeah.
And what he does.
Yeah, I remember there was something inside me, and it was that feeling we have where we look at the accident at the side of the highway. For some reason, I was sort of compelled to look back into the observation cell that Joseph was just talking about. And this guy's in the restraint chair. He's strapped in. He's in a terrible state. And I looked back at him and he raised his bloody face. His chin was on his chest. He raised his face. He looked me right in the eye, smiled and winked at me.
What do you take from that he was not in his right mind, or that this had he become normalized to this kind of treatment?
Well, I'm stabbing a guess at that. To him, it was the only attention he was getting, and that it was his way of having, as perverse as it sounds, some form of human connection.
Because he'd been isolated.
Yeah, and all he was doing with me was registering that.
I agree with that. I mean, I was in a solitary confinement unit, and many people down there don't understand is that, you know, I mean, you're deprived of any kind of like outside stimuli. I mean, you might get 2 or 3 books a week, and I mean, you know, how long can you read that? And so outside of that, these guys, you know, these young guys who get trapped in there, you know, the borderline, you know, having mental disorders, they're looking for something just to get something, you know, feel something, see something, anything, because once you're trapped in that room, you're only stuck in your mind, and that's it. The only person you got to talk to is you.
So even if they get brutalized, at least something is happening involving other humans. And the other inmates in this unit are also excited for what they see as, quote unquote, the show.
Yeah, the show's on. It's the best thing that can happen that day.
The only thing that can happen outside of their routine.
Let's go to Chris in Portland. Hi, Chris. Welcome to Maine Calling.
Hey, guys. How you doing?
Good, thanks.
How you doing?
Hey, Chris.
Hey. I was actually calling you in so many ways. You definitely touched on it. I just wanted to find out, we've all seen every depiction of, Hollywood's inmate story and et cetera. And, they really paint, obviously, a pretty harsh picture and so many things, like Orange is the New Black, where, the hierarchy of, I guess, the prison community, inmates and otherwise, really put you into a position where you're constantly, under threat. And I guess I just wanted to find out, how real is this for, an everyday, every hour, situation for the average inmate.
Yeah, we do have a lot of depictions on TV and which dramatize the danger inside prison from other inmates, et cetera. Joseph Jackson, how well is that portrayed?
I can tell you this: I went to the Thomaston, and so the biggest most violent thing I saw at one point was just regular fist fights, and we had access to almost everything because the craft room and the wood shop, and so nobody was really violent because there was a lot of incentive. As the system became more and more punitive and prisoners began to feel like there's no difference between being punished and not being punished, there are those, especially those with borderline, mental disorders, they feel like they have nothing to lose. And so, yes, sometimes, people do get targeted. But for the most part, most fights just end in just like regular high school fist fights, and then it's over. And so that, for me, that's my experience of it. I really never had – I had one fist fight the entire time I was in prison, so and that was 20 years.
Yeah. Was Pennsylvania different from Maine?
It was different in the fact that the guard community and the prisoner community was dramatically different. So there would be, a lot of African-American guards, a lot of Hispanic guards, and a good amount of Asian guards and women on the job, too. In Maine, it's predominantly tough, white, working class men. And that really, and on both sides of the bars too. Joseph and I were talking before we got on air here. And when I was up there, I think including the Native American inmates and the African, there was maybe 40 or 50 minority guys there out of 1,000. In Pennsylvania, the guard staff and the inmate staff mirrored each other up here. So it really creates a very sort of narrow socioeconomic dynamic.
1-800-399-3566. We'll go to North Yarmouth and Bruce. Hi, Bruce.
Hi there.
Hi.
I'll preface this by saying my son is a resident at Warren, has been for about a year, and he'll have another 3 years there. You're talking a lot about the guards, and unfortunately for the guards, they have, it seems that a lot of them have no control over their lives outside of Warren. And inside, they're kind of bored. It's kind of a boring job at times. And it's a chance for them to have some control. And even if the situation isn't really that great or even, that tough for these guys, they almost at times create problems for themselves and create problems for the inmates themselves. And the other thing is there's really very little for rehabilitation for most of these guys that are there, and a good portion of them are there that are there have mental disorders, whether they're diagnosed or not. And thanks for listening.
All right, thank you, Bruce. I'll ask Joseph about the rehabilitation, but on the guard side, you actually in your book paint a pretty empathetic a picture of what the guards are going through. They're not paid a lot. They're understaffed. They're working forced overtime. So there were good guards and bad guards. What's your, the takeaway of how you would characterize what it's like to be a guard in the Maine State Prison?
Yeah, just just to jump back to what we were talking about before and how the media or Hollywood dramatizes what happens in prison, what they don't do and what they can never get at is the enormous amounts of dead time for both inmates and staff. They're interested in drama and action. There is a massive amount of every day where there is nothing going on. So our caller, was it Chris? Some of these people they're creating drama because they're bored. And in the book, I talk about, in broad strokes, the body of staff, half of them don't get paid enough or recognized nearly enough for what they do. But I felt in both places, half of them had no business being in charge of other human beings, and more so at the main state prison, because the screening process was almost, the psychological screening process was almost non-existent. At least in Pennsylvania, they were asking me, did I want to be a florist or a lumberjack? Up here, if you could breathe and run up the hill, you had a job.
And on the rehabilitation side, Joseph, I think there's a public perception of, inmates can get a college degree. They have all this time. What are the opportunities?
Well, I can tell you, it's extremely difficult to get a college degree. I mean, I got one, but I had to have assistance from the outside and from other people. And there were programs that were in place that helped me get my degree. One of the things that is happening, these programs are becoming few and far between now. Second is, there is no incentive for the Department of Corrections for a prisoner to better themselves. The department, according to this policy right now, they're not giving out good time if a guy goes to class or if he gets mental abuse or goes to substance abuse. They can't. They can only give it to him for work. They're not, they're only paying one third of the population. So there really is no reward. And so the only way they get trying to get these prisoners to do this is through punishment. To say, if you don't go, I'm going to punish you. So what you have is prisoners just sitting in another room, just passing time and not really getting anything out of the program they're in, because they're just, they've been forced to do it instead of being incentivized to do it.
All right, let's go to Jack in Brunswick. Hi, Jack. Yes, hi, go ahead, please.
I have experience as a volunteer chaplain in the Florida Correctional System, maximum security, and I'm up here in Maine doing the same thing. And I just want to offer a couple of observations to the discussion. First thing, in Florida, where I was, the correctional officers were highly screened but incredibly poorly paid, not much above minimum wage. I come to Maine and discover that, by and large, the correctional officers are even more poorly paid than that. That being said, additionally, Maine State currently is 50 correctional officers short. Therefore, you're looking at more than overtime. You're looking at an absence of supervision, and you're looking at people who are beginning to resent the workload that they're given. In reflection on the gentleman who, and to his credit, has survived and made a great deal out of himself after going through the system here, and that is a rarity. I believe it's a rarity because the correctional system is so incredibly underfunded in Maine. Education is underfunded. Public services are underfunded. But the correctional system, even more so. I don't think it's a matter of not availing inmates of programming. I think it's simply a matter of not being able to staff, even when the will is there in administration. So thank you for letting me share.
All right, Jack, thank you for joining us again. The number is 800-399-3566. We'll take another short break, and when we come back, more of your comments and questions. This is Maine Calling. Stay with us.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Revision Energy, partnering with home and business owners to build community solar farms across Maine. More at revisionenergy.com. Space Gallery in Portland, presenting the indie rock music of Myra on June 13th. More information and tickets at space538.org. And Casella, handling over 1 million pounds of recyclables daily in the state of Maine. Casella, giving resources new life.
Taxed off. How Americans really feel about taxes.
Taxes can never be perfect.
Well, the income tax, where should I start?
I think you're looking at kind of a tax giveaway zone.
We'll take a closer look at the grand experiment that is the U.S. tax system.
It just doesn't seem to make a lot of sense right now.
And you can hear that program coming up in about 20 minutes at 1 o'clock.
Do you ever look at someone and wonder, what is going on inside their head?
The new animated Disney Pixar film, Inside Out, is all about what goes on inside the mind of a child, where joy, fear, anger, sadness, and disgust are at the controls. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Pete Docter, who directed Inside Out, as well as Monsters, Inc. and Up. Join us.
Join us for Fresh Air this evening at 7 o'clock.
Welcome back. I'm Keith Shortall. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, what life is like inside prison. With me in the studio, Robert Riley. He worked as a prison guard for 6 years, leaving the corrections system in 2007. He today lives in Midcoast, Maine with his wife and 3 children and works as an outdoor education instructor. He's the author of Life in Prison, 8 Hours at a Time. Joseph Jackson, also with us today. He's a former prisoner, now coordinator of the Maine Prisoner Advocacy Coalition. Join the conversation. Give us a call. The number is 800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. Joseph Jackson, I want to talk about the advocacy situation here. I recall that a few years ago there was an official prisoner, you know, advocate position at the prisons. How effective was that? What do we have now, and what should we have?
Well, the position was never effective because it was viewed as just being another arm of the department. But it was better than having no advocate whatsoever. Now prisoners are left, you know, to fend for themselves, and now not very good. I think what's needed is that the department has to somehow find a way to get advocates for the facility, but not look as though that they're the ones doing it. Maybe put out a grant to an advocacy group or something to advocate for prisoners. There are many things within the system that is messed up, like the disciplinary policy. It's not just a grievance policy. I mean, a prisoner can't even call a witness to, you know, defend himself in a hearing. They've been charged fines, you know what I mean, for something as simple as leaving a cup in the window. $50, in fact. And so what do you get $50 if you're a prisoner with no job? So these are the kind of things that we have to do as advocates, to try to fix and improve our system, because it's in serious need of reform.
And all sides acknowledge that there are some frivolous cases, but there are also some legitimate ones that you believe are thrown out. Yeah. With the others.
Well, I believe that, when you're talking about grievances, yes, of course you're going to have, there are guys that want better food. You think that's a frivolous grievance. But there are also times when a guy's diet is important. If he's a Muslim guy, or if he's a Jewish guy, or even if he has a special kind of health condition. If a guy complains about that and then it just gets thrown out as being frivolous, then we're looking at, a really serious issue. The problem is that a lot of these cases just being thrown out on technicalities and not being taken into consideration what the merit of the argument is in the first place. And I think if we can get them to at least look at that, we will be making progress moving forward.
Well, let's go to Steve in Deer Isle. Hi, Steve.
Hi.
Hi.
My name is Steve Lewicki. I'm the former coordinator of the Maine Advocacy.
How you doing, Steve?
And a friend of Joe. How are you, Joe?
I'm doing well, man.
I'm doing. Hey, I'm just calling to say thank you for this work that you're continuing to do, and I'm following everything you're doing, and we'll be in touch soon. I also want to thank former Officer Riley for the courage to talk about some of the things he's talking about, especially since he still lives in the Midcoast, and I'm sure he still runs into some of his former colleagues.
Yeah, well, that is. Let's ask you then right now. It's a good point, Steve. Any repercussions from this still living in the community where you have kind of, you've written this book and put it out there?
It's very interesting, and it's something I thought about, and it's something I talked about with my wife, and certainly my publisher too, and my agent. The reaction has been exactly the same from everybody I've met, and I have met many people since the book came out in November. They've all said it's not on the target, it's a bullseye. The people who are working at the Maine State Prison have all said to me, and a prison I worked at in Pennsylvania, have said, you're exactly right. I'm glad you've said it. I haven't heard one negative piece. In fact, someone who I'm friends with who's in the administration was about to take me to task about it. I'll leave his name out of it. And I said, I am only going to tell it. Actually, I was doing the 207 piece.
Which is a local TV. Portland TV. Yeah.
And he was quizzing me about what was going to get talked about and what I might say. And I said, I will only ever say the truth. I'll tell the truth. I said, you know that, especially when I worked there, and that's what I'm talking about in the book, very bad things were happening to inmates via the administration, through the conduit of the staff body. Very bad things were happening. So the reaction has been very positive. Everybody said, I'm glad somebody's talking about it.
Let's go to Orland and Margaret. Hi, Margaret.
Hi.
Hi.
Okay. I'm just wondering if people are taking into account the fairly famous study done at Stanford University in the late 50s, early 60s, called the Prisoner Project. And yeah. I was a student there at the time, graduate school, and they had used undergraduate students as subjects, as they call it, them in those days, for their experiments. And they randomly assigned half of them to be prisoners and the other half to be guards. And they had a mock-up of a prison down in the basement there. And they had to suspend this this study after 2 weeks because the guards were abusing the students. Now, the take on that by the social psychologist was that it was not that guards have a particular proclivity to becoming guards because they're sadistic or, you know, they have mental issues there, but that it has something to do with just the structure of unequal power and the guards having so much power over those that are incarcerated. Yep. So that should be taken into account in this whole discussion, I think.
Did you? Yeah, go ahead. Yeah.
I was going to say I agree, but and imagine now that, you know, the majority of the staff don't even require, you know, an undergraduate degree. They require a GED. So, you know, you don't even have educated people, you know, being, you know, you got that were being influenced in this way. These people have limited education. So imagine the influence that kind of power has on them.
Did you feel, Robert, that you changed over the course of
your... Oh, I definitely changed through the seven-year period, especially at home. I was, and my wife pointed it out, and I'm grateful for that, you know, I was becoming very short-tempered. I had little kids in the house. I mean, I got angry with the kids when they were doing what kids do, not listening. You have to reiterate over and over again. I remember becoming angry and feeling violent, you know, feeling very frustrated at home after work and feeling very, I felt violent towards my coworkers when I had a disagreement. I mean, I felt like fighting.
Let's go to Joe in Rockland. Hi, Joe.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
A comment on we have more people in prison than any other country in the world, I think, or per capita. And prisons now being privatized, so the profit motive in running a prison. Did your guest one think this could lead to the quality of the guards, in other words, the spread so thin? And I'd like to get their reaction to the recent escape from the Dannemora facility in New York.
Okay. This is a good chance. We only have a few minutes left, but I did want to say, what's the prescription here? You have some thoughts. I know both of you on what could be done tomorrow to improve the way that the system runs. Joseph, we'll start with you.
Well, I think the first thing we have to do is change our system from one that's based on a punitive stance to one that's based on rewards. Right now, we only have one third of, you know, the entire prison population that have paying jobs. So if we start extending paying jobs, we automatically change the environment just with that one move from one based on a system that's on punishment to one that mirrors the environment they're going to come out to. And so I think that's one of the things we have to do is start looking at the policy level decisions and policies and how it affects the overall population and begin to look at ways where we can change the way that stands.
Yeah. Robert?
20 years ago, there was 500,000 inmates in American prisons. Today, there's 2.5 million. Under correctional control and jurisdiction, there's over 7 million. what's talked about as the American industrial prison complex is a multi-billion dollar industry. To address the point from the caller, non-violent crimes. If non-violent inmates were educated and not sent to prison, it would dramatically reduce the entire problem. Workload on state and local cops, workloads on the court systems, workload on the prison systems, and the money, you know, needing to be spent there would be reduced dramatically.
You say 50% of the inmates don't belong there. The other 50% should never be let out.
I totally believe that. You know, there are, Joseph and I were talking from our separate perspectives prior to the show. There are some very, very bad people who are threats to the community and our wives and our children and our businesses. And they should not be out there. But half of them shouldn't be in.
The caller also asked about the escape, which is on the top of the news. Any thoughts?
The stuff of Hollywood, isn't it?
I was thinking about Shawshank, you know. about the movie
which
Shawshank.
Which was based on Thomaston.
Yeah, it was based on Thomaston. So, you know, we had the same kind of metal walls and things like that. So, yeah, that's what I thought of.
Yeah, there is something, I guess it's intriguing about when prisoners get out of this really incredibly protective system. It's almost as if we're fascinated by this.
Well, we're fascinated by anybody stuck on a desert island. We're fascinated by anybody stuck in a spaceship or in a boat or down a mine shaft or stuck in a prison. When somebody's trapped and needs or wants or has the desire to escape, we're fascinated by that. It's human nature.
All right, Robert, Joseph, thank you both for being here today. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Keith.
Thank you.
Robert Riley worked as a prison guard for 6 years, leaving the correction system in 2007. He's the author of Life in Prison, 8 Hours at a Time. Joseph Jackson is the coordinator of the Maine Prisoner Advocacy Coalition. John Keimel ran the board today. Our volunteer Tommy Bazarian answered your calls. You can find past editions of Maine Calling as well as a link to our audio archives by visiting mpbn.net/Maine Calling. Tomorrow on the program, host Jennifer Rooks broadcasting live from AARP Maine's Scam Jam at the Augusta Civic Center. The focus of the event is helping Mainers recognize common scams and fraud that target older citizens and how to avoid becoming a victim. I'm Keith Shortall. You've been listening to Maine Calling on the Maine Public Broadcasting Network.